that works. We've, over the past few weeks, been taking a journey through the letter of James. Now, this letter was written to many churches and many places with the intention of giving us practical advice on how we can live out our faith in our daily lives. And so last week, we reflected on the importance of controlling our speech. And for James, our words have the power to create worlds of meaning, just as God's words have the power to create the world that we live in. And so our words, they can hinder or they can help. They can hurt or they can heal. They can humiliate or they can honor. And we were challenged to consider the ways in which we use our words to speak new worlds of possibility and blessing for others. And so this week, James continues his reflection by considering the difference between wise and worldly leadership. Now, before I became pastor at Vienna Baptist Church, I spent 2 years of pastoral residency program at Wilshire Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas. The residency program, it provides intentional training and mentorship to recent seminary graduates who are pursuing a call to the senior pastorate in the context of a healthy local church. And the program was started and continues to be led by Wilshire senior pastor, Dr. George Mason. George, for my time as a resident, served as a mentor to me, and he continues to be a colleague of support in ministry, someone I go to when I need advice. And I may be biased, but I think George is a great pastor, and I continue to rely on much of his wisdom about ministry to this day. And one of the lessons that I distinctly remember George telling residents was that good leaders are always quick to use two phrases: thank you and I'm sorry. Thank you and I'm sorry. He said it's so important to celebrate the contributions of all the amazing volunteers that make churches run, to model a spirit of gratitude where the gifts that people share are celebrated. Most pastors and leaders, many of them, they understand the importance of saying thank you. Right? Where we struggle, George liked to say, is that willingness and readiness to admit when we've made mistakes and to take responsibility. Good leaders don't try to blame someone else for their mistakes. They're the first to raise their hand and say, "I'm sorry, that was my fault. I take full responsibility. How do we move forward together and make this right?" Learning to say thank you and I'm sorry. To this day, I think that's one of the best lessons about leadership that I've ever learned. And I would probably give my right arm if every CEO, every member of Congress and the White House, every leader everywhere, if everyone led with those two principles in mind, the world would be a different place, don't you think? We always admire the leaders who model passing on credit and taking blame. But most of the time, this is not the kind of leadership that we see in the world around us. We're accustomed to finger-pointing and passing blame like a game of hot potato. And people behave this way because they're jockeying for status and power. We do this when we are constantly competing to prove that we are better than everybody else. And so we can't say thank you because we've got to be able to take the credit for ourselves. We can't say I'm sorry because I need someone else to take the blame. And James says this kind of behavior, it breaks down loving community, particularly in the church. And it damages our relationships and it wounds our hearts. And so he lays out for us the ways good leaders in the church, but also in the wider community, should lead. Above all, he says, they should lead with wisdom and understanding. Now, this is a description that in the Bible we've seen many times. It echoes the qualities of the great leaders of the Old Testament, like David and Moses, in those moments when they obeyed the commandments of God and sought to advance the causes of justice, love, and mercy. And just in case we were looking for a few more descriptors, those behaviors of wise leaders, James continues on. He says, the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. A rare breed of leaders he's described. In short, James says, godly leaders, those with wisdom and understanding, they make peace. Now keep in mind that peace in the Bible means something much more than the absence of conflict. In the New Testament, the word for peace, it connotes this idea of harmony amongst people in their relationships that leads to safety, prosperity, and fulfillment. If we are behaving like godly leaders, the ways we are called to lead and to live in all our relationships, then they should produce deeper connection and greater fulfillment in our lives and in the lives of those around us. And we can't do this when we are constantly trying to compete with the people around us, when we're trying to blame them for what went wrong. This kind of worldly leadership, James says, it only produces more division. It only produces greater conflict. It only creates disorder. And what's true for leaders of congregations and communities is true for every one of us, even in our own personal lives, right? There's a popular psychologist that is popular in my household. Her name is Dr. Brené Brown. She happens to be a Texan. That's not useful to this story, but I'm a Texan, and so I have to say that. She tells this funny story about this time in her life when she realized the extent to which she is a blamer, right? And so one morning, she's in her house, and she is wearing white slacks and a pink sweater set. And she is drinking a big cup of coffee that she has filled to the brim. And she's there in her kitchen, and then all of a sudden, the mug falls out of her hands onto the tile floor. It shatters into a million pieces and splashes coffee all over her. It ruins her outfit just as she needs to, you know, start making her way out the door. And the first words out of her mouth, like a millisecond after, the very first words are, "Curse you, Steve." By the way, that was edited for our younger audience here. Now, Steve is Dr. Brown's husband, right? Let's explain how this worked. So the night before, Steve was out. He plays water polo with some friends. He was out a little bit later than expected, and Brené Brown is staying up to see her husband before she went to sleep, and because he got home late, she went to bed later than she had planned. Therefore, when she got up in the morning, she's more tired than usual, so she needed a second cup of coffee, which she usually doesn't have, and that was the cup of coffee that fell to the ground and spilled all over her, making it Steve's fault. Now, how many of you have done something like this? Or how many of you, like right now, are saying, oh, yeah, that's totally Steve's fault, right? Yeah, absolutely, that's Steve's fault. Okay? How many of you, like, when something bad happens, the first thing that you think of, like the very first thing, is whose fault is this? Right? I need to find them. We do this all the time, right? Most of us, if we're honest, like, we would prefer for something to be our fault than no one's fault. Why? It gives us this semblance of control, right? We can understand our life. There's no chance. There's no luck to it. It's always going to be Steve's fault. We can assign that blame there. We can put the boundaries around it. So whether it's the cup of coffee that spills on us or the reason why our kids weren't signed up for soccer on time, we are always on the lookout for blame. And sometimes it happens in milliseconds. Now, what's interesting is that all of this reflexive habits that we have, this mindset, it actually doesn't improve our lives at all, right? Here's what Dr. Brown says after doing some research on her own, you know, kind of life here. She says this: blame is simply the discharging of discomfort and pain. Blame is simply the discharging of discomfort and pain. It has an inverse relationship with accountability. Because accountability, by definition, is a vulnerable process. It means calling you and saying, hey, my feelings were hurt about this, and talking, not blaming. Blaming is simply the way we discharge anger. Now, those of you still hung up on Steve are probably thinking, yeah, but Austin, somebody's got to be held responsible for this, right? Or nothing will ever change. But it's important to realize that there is a very distinct difference between accountability, where we take responsibility for speaking and acting in alignment with those things that we've said is most important to us, and blaming, where we assign guilt without any honest self-reflection of how we've been injured, or vulnerable conversation about the consequences of certain actions. And research shows that people who do a lot of blaming rarely have the tenacity and grit to actually practice accountability. Mainly because we don't have the energy for it. We exhaust so much of our energy in the 15 seconds or 15 minutes of just raging about it that we no longer have the energy to have a conversation that leads to accountability. Blaming is corrosive to our relationships, and it's destructive to community. Dr. Brown says it's also one of the reasons why we miss our opportunities for connection and empathy, because I'm so busy trying to assign blame or listening for who's at fault that I'm not actually listening to what you're telling me. Or I'm so mad at who or what I'm blaming, I don't take time to reflect on why my feelings were hurt, or even to consider how you may be feeling. Blaming keeps us from embracing one another because we're too busy swinging our fists, right? And you can't hug somebody who's throwing punches at you. And this is why James tells us that you can't have a loving and caring community when the leaders of the community and the members of the community are so busy blaming each other that they don't have any time to create peace and understanding. Everybody's in a boxing match with one another. Now, I recognize, as I believe James does, that this is all easier said than done. It takes an enormous amount of self-awareness and self-discipline in that moment when someone says something to you or something bad happens to take a deep breath and a step back. Right? It is not natural for us to do that, to stand there and ask yourself, okay, Austin, what's really upsetting you right now? What expectation is not going to be to be met, and or maybe like what issue from your family history is being triggered right now. And as someone who has spent years working on my own issues with anger and blame, I can tell you that it is hard enough to do this when you spill coffee, much less when you've been betrayed by a family member or heard some painful words spoken from a close friend. And for those of you who are like me and you don't see yourself acting in godly and wise ways in every moment of your life, as James describes, take heart. James has no intention of kicking all of us out of the church for not saying thank you and I'm sorry often enough. If you remember from last week, James says the behaving in this kind of way all the time is only performed by perfect people, and none of us are perfect. In fact, the church is meant for imperfect people, and so all of us are going to be in a state of learning and growth. Our faith is about going on a journey, not sitting at a destination. And this is actually how James understands the process of conversion. I mean, deciding to follow Jesus is not something you do once in your life and it's over. You spend the rest of your life as this perfect Christian in great harmony with all of the world. Conversion is never complete. It's an ongoing process of growing into the likeness of Christ in all we think, say, and do. It's why spiritual formation in community groups, in mission projects, on retreats is so important at Vienna Baptist. Because we realize that we're always learning. We always are in this process of having our hearts shaped and reshaped as we open them up to God. Every day, you and I have to decide to follow Jesus anew. To learn to value the things that God values. New Testament scholar Luke Timothy Johnson puts it this way: complete consistency in life is not given by the first commitment. It is slowly and painfully won through many conversions. This realization gives us deeper insight into what James means by faith's being tested through many trials, and why it should be counted as all the joy when such trials occur. Each such test is a possibility for growth and for a new conversion from the measure of the world to the measure of God. Wisdom is not about knowing everything. That's perfect knowledge. Wisdom is about understanding where you begin and where you end. What is yours and what is not yours. Understanding who God is and how your life fits into that creation. The wisest among us know that they are in a constant state of learning, that life is growth without end. And when you can come to this place and accept this in your life, you can give up that work of blaming, because it's no longer important when we face challenges to figure out who didn't do something right or why it didn't go perfectly, because we're more attentive to what God might be showing us in this situation. How might that current issue you're dealing with be an opportunity to practice grace, to practice forgiveness, to practice patience, honesty, vulnerability? Some of the times when I have learned the most about myself and my wife are in the moments when we've had the most heated arguments about something. And usually her, it's not me because I'm a hothead. Usually in those moments, there's a stop and let's talk about what we're actually angry about right now, because it's not about the coffee being spilled, right? And in those moments of sharing, I learn more about her, she learns about me, and we've found a deeper connection. Right? The same is true of my faith. If I'm to tell you the most pivotal moments in my relationship with God, it's been those prayers when I've been most honest and vulnerable about what's going on. And it's those prayers that have led to greater comfort and hope for me. And I don't say all this because I've mastered this. And here I am as your guru to tell you. I'm telling you this as someone who's seen some glimpses in my life in certain moments that has led me to believe that the way James is laying out how we should live our lives is the way I'd like to live my life. And then I'm trying to figure out how to do that in more moments in my life. Because it's God's deepest desire for us that we would experience deeper joy and love and fulfillment. That we would move away from those tendencies of anger and blame so they wouldn't run us ragged or cause us to self-destruct. And we daily have the opportunity to look at the situations that we encounter every day as opportunities to pursue new learning about ourselves or someone else, to discover new growth, to experience change. And so this week, I want you to try and practice that wise reflection that leads to healthy relationships and stronger community. Because guaranteed, just by being a human and being alive, or maybe just because we have extra pressures because we live in Northern Virginia, there is guaranteed going to be something that is going to make you mad this week. Something that is going to upset you. Your plans are going to get changed at the last minute. Someone is going to say something hurtful to you. Someone is going to cut you off in traffic. And in those moments, if you can find one, it's not going to happen in everyone, but if you find one and you've got enough awareness in that moment, I want you, before that anger begins to get vomited up as blame, take three deep breaths. And take one step back. And instead of blaming someone or something for why your plans got ruined, think about what expectation has just kind of let you down. That feeling of being deflated, think about that. In that moment when someone says something hurtful to you, right before you start swinging your fists, I want you to ask yourself, why did what they say hurt you? And what makes you particularly vulnerable to that attack? Other things roll right off you, but this one in particular has got you. Why is that? When someone cuts you off in traffic, just don't run them off the road, right? Let's start there. Let's be realistic in our steps. Because if we can learn more and more to practice what James says, of being quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. In those moments, while you're practicing that, I promise you that a better way of responding, something that looks more peaceful, something that looks like more understanding, something that looks like a healthier relationship, it'll begin to open itself up to you. But it won't if we keep ourselves blinded by anger and blame. We keep our ears closed off to one another. You may even discover something new about yourself that you didn't realize. You may discover something new about the other person. Set a goal this week, even if it's we're only able to do it just once. But for one moment, let's see if we can capture that glimpse of what it would look like in our lives if we practice this kind of peace and patience in that moment when anger starts to bubble up. Or we can become the people who live peacefully, gently, humbly, mercifully, and justly. And it's in this way that we discover more fulfilling relationships, stronger community, and greater peace with God, in ourselves, and with one another. May we discover those wise ways today. Amen.